Miki and Sionji were back in the library in an hour, looking worn but relatively pleased under the circumstances.
"How is she?"
Utena asked quietly. Miki let himself fall into an armchair, checked his stopwatch, and replied, "She's very upset. She never took the time to talk to Liza after everything that happened last spring. Before we went to Dantrov, she was still holding on to too much anger, and when we got back, of course, Liza had gone. Azalin thought she'd have the opportunity to make everything right again when Liza got back, and now..." He spread his hands. "Now she may never get the chance. And she's upset with herself for getting so angry with Clarissa. It's a vicious cycle she's not sure how to break," added Sionji, rubbing his face with both hands. Miki nodded agreement. "She's sleeping now," he said. "We persuaded her that perhaps a nap would improve her perspective, or at least bring her better news when she wakes."
"No joy yet," Skaya said glumly.
Mia Ausa trotted in then, carrying a large metal-strapped book with her and looking excited about something. Belana was right behind her, also looking pleased, but the both of them came to an abrupt halt as they felt the atmosphere in the game room.
"What's the matter?" asked Mia.
Sky told her.
"Oh, that's awful," said Mia, looking downcast.
She closed the heavy book on her thumb and said,
"Never mind."
"No, tell us," said Kate.
With a wry smile, she added,
"We all need some cheering up."
"All right," Mia replied, a bit hesitantly. Then she laid the book down on the pool table and said,
"I knew this building looked familiar when I first saw it, but I couldn't place it because I hadn't looked at this book in a couple of years."
As the duelists crowded around, she opened the book to the page she'd marked. And there was the castle, drawn across the two-page spread in black and pastel inks, slightly faded against the yellowing parchment, but still quite clear. Around it were markings, text in some swooping, curved, and flourished script, that looked a little like Arabic.
"Wow," said Utrina. "What's the book?"
Mia smiled. "It's an ancient Atlantean text about the Order of Jedi Knights. They were an order of mystic warriors that flourished during the previous epoch, the last cycle of great galactic civilizations. Headquartered on Atlantis, but their influence was felt throughout the galaxy. They fell at about the same time as Atlantis itself, before the rise of Corellia and Seleucia. But some say there are still a few of them out on the Outer Rim, passing the techniques down and keeping some vestige of the Order alive."
Kate nodded. "One of the founders of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu was a Jedi Knight. He lived in the mid-21st century.
Mia looked interested.
"Really? Did he leave behind any writings?"
A few. You'd have to ask Dad.
Next time I see him, I think I will. Anyway, at the height of their power, the Jedi Order built temples all over the galaxy. Most were destroyed in the wars that led to the collapse of the epoch, but a few survived, mostly on Outer Rim worlds, and there are images in the books of the time."
She tapped the picture with a fingertip. "This building is an ancient Jedi temple. They must have had a presence on Bajor."
That's not surprising," said Miki. "I've been reading a bit about Bajor. Major Kira gave me a very interesting book on the planet's history. Their civilization's continuity of history goes back almost 25,000 years, to the epoch before Atlantis. So to them, a Jedi presence during the last epoch would have been a passing fad,
Bajorans didn't even live on Gerardo back then.
They practically don't now,
Sionji observed in a dry murmur, causing Miki to give him a wry little grin. So, Miki went on doggedly, it's not too surprising that when they did come, no one knew what this old building had been. Despite having had starfaring technology for millennia, the Bajorans have only very recently come to take an interest in the worlds beyond their own.
So, said Utena thoughtfully, the reason the big room downstairs feels so much like a dojo
is because it is a dojo, said Mia, nodding. It must be the room where the Jedi practiced their fighting techniques. They fought with projected energy swords, lightsabers, they were called. I saw one once. There's one in the Great Library, preserved from the days when there were Jedi on Minbar. They're incredible pieces of technology, light years beyond the modern mass-produced beam sabers.
Kate nodded. Dad has one. It's supposed to have belonged to Talar Kem, the Jedi who helped Tetsuo Asagiri found the Katsujin Kenri. Ryu.
Well, said Sionji, that seems an auspicious bit of news for our society.
Shame it had to come on such a dark day, though, said Mia glumly.
Actually, I think it's good, said Miki. It gives us a bit of light, so the day won't have been completely given up to sadness.
Said Tiny Robo with a grave little nod. Utena absently patted him on the head. Mia nodded.
That's a good way to look at it, she mused softly. Well, if you have any news, please let me know. I'll be upstairs, putting away the last of my books, then meditating upon the crystals.
Course registration day dawned rainy, gray, and dreary, one of the first really lousy days they'd had since coming to Gerardo. It suited the general mood fairly well, as students dressed in the black rain capes or trench coats of the DSM uniform made their way around the suddenly sodden campus, forming long lines in the student center's grand ballroom to sign up for their A-term classes. There was something amusing, Utrinet decided, about 1,000 soggy teenagers standing around in bank-teller-like lines in a grandiose, high-ceilinged, chandeliered, hyper-elegant room like this one, dripping onto the plastic sheeting which had been laid down over the magnificent mosaic floor, with its grand reproduction of the DSM seal and its motto, Nolite equipere ullos ligneos sestertios. For the first two terms at the Diedlitz Ettore Mandeville Memorial Institute, the uniform of the now-defunct Worcester Preparatory Institute would be acceptable garb for those former WPI students who had made the transfer to DSM. By Christmas, everybody was expected to have switched over to the new standard. Not that they were all that much different. Both uniforms specified a black and gray checked skirt, black V-neck sweater vest and white shirt for girls, and black dress shorts or trousers with black suit jacket for boys. Both had red accents, socks, tie for boys, neckerchief for girls. The main differences were in the boys' uniforms. DSM had chosen to dispense with the charcoal gray dress shirt in favor of a more conventional white, and the jackets were double-breasted instead of single. Shoes were still left up to the students' discretion within limits, as were headgear and accessories. As at WPI, there was no actual school rule specifying the girls' uniform exclusively for girls' wear, or the boys' for boys. And so, Utena Tencho stood in line for class registration, right about on the U in Ulos, wearing a double-breasted jacket and black shorts, her tie neatly knotted, hands in her shorts' pockets pinning back the tails of her trench coat, with galoshes over her usual black-and-white saddle shoes and her non-regulation black fedora hat on her head.
The hat's a good choice, Wakaba Shinohara informed her. Without it, the trench coat and the jacket would kind of give you an Ilsa, she-wolf of the SS look.
Utena rolled her eyes.
"Where'd you get that hat, anyway?" Wakaba asked. "Sort of a present from Corwin last New Year's," Utrina replied, smiling fondly at the memory. "He was wearing it when the bunch of us left the house to go downtown for the big New Year's Eve bash they have in New Avalon every year. I complained that if he was wearing a hat I couldn't fuss with his hair, so he took it off and plunked it on me instead." "At which point," said Dorothy Wainwright with a hint of amusement, "it became yours forevermore." "How romantic," said Wakaba dryly. "Don't you think it suits her, though?" asked Dorothy. She, like Wakaba, had opted for the usual girl's outfit. With a bit of autumn chill in the air to ring in September, both, like most girls on campus today, were wearing the optional black leggings for warmth. Dorothy didn't really need them, but she liked the effect they presented. Like Utrina, she was wearing a hat, in her case a neat little round one with a broad brim. Wakaba's onion of hair was looking a bit wilted because she'd decided not to wear one or put her rain cape's hood up for the dash from the castle to the ballroom. "Oh, definitely," Wakaba agreed, nodding and giving Utrina an appraising look. Then she glanced next to the pink-haired duelist, who was looking comically put upon, and saw that Caitlin was frowning at something across the room through her slightly fogged-up glasses. "Something wrong, Kate?" she asked. "You're quieter than usual this morning." "That's Clarissa," Kate murmured, as if to herself. "Damn." Wakaba and Dorothy turned to look. Utrina didn't have to. Clarissa Broadbank was indeed standing in one of the other reg lines, chatting with returning sophomore Carol Alverson, one of Clarissa's sister Liza's former brigade. As the four castle dwellers watched, the two girls shared a laugh about something. "Looks like she's taking over right where Liza left off," said Wakaba unhappily. "Just like she said she would yesterday," Utrina added glumly. "I hoped she was just trying to get Kate's goat saying that." Caitlin looked at the two in the other line for a moment longer, then shrugged slightly. "We'll handle her," she said. In the line on their other side, a few places back, Jacron of Narn found himself bumped by someone who was slipping through the line on his way across the room, a pink special reg form, requiring him to consult with one of the guidance counselors on the far side, in his hand. "Pardon me," said the bumper, "but..."
"Great Maker, Jacron!"
Jacron blinked, then drew back until he bumped the person behind him.
"Marmo!"
he bellowed, causing many people, including Kate and her party, to turn and look. Standing face to face with Jacron, his arms outstretched to mirror the Narn's gesture of surprised, pleased welcome, was a tall, broad-shouldered young man with the characteristically upstanding, fanned-out hairstyle of a centauri belonging to a family of some importance. The hair in the fan was a dull red, a bit streaky, as if it had been partially highlighted. The centauri himself had a rather patrician nose and a prominent chin. Centauri and Narns generally didn't like each other very much. The Centauri Republic had conquered and occupied Narn for a good bit of the previous century, and there were still a lot of hurt feelings about the whole affair. So there was a good bit of tension in the room, as the two young men stood staring at each other. But then they crashed together into a vehement, back-slapping embrace, and it seemed that all would be well, so most of the room lost interest.
"Who's that?" Wakaba wondered.
"Search me," Utrina told her.
"Beld Marmo," said Kate. "Kron's old roommate. He left WPI last Christmas."
"Ah, the whole PsyAct thing," said Wakaba, nodding. She'd heard all about it, over 50 students from nations which had decided to protest the expansion to the Psionics Regulation and Protection Act by pulling their nationals out of the Earth Alliance, gone from the previous school year's holiday break and never returned.
"Indeed," said a soft, pleasant voice from next to them.
Many of us who were lost to the Institute at that time have accepted President Tiefeld's invitation to rejoin the community we were forced to leave. Wakaba turned to see who was speaking and found herself face to face with a rather sharp-faced young man who had short-clipped black hair, slightly greenish skin, and pointed ears. He nodded cordially to her. Caitlin smiled.
Strom, she said. Welcome back.
Strom inclined his head to Kate as well and replied, Peace and long life, Caitlin Hutchins. It is agreeable to see you again. That was pretty effusive for a Vulcan, and brought a little smile to Kate's face as she asked,
Professor Stuvek?
Yes, Strom replied. He is in his office unpacking his books. I believe he would also find it agreeable to see you again. He added with just the faintest touch of humor. Ah, my line moves. I must keep up or be left behind. Live long and prosper, Caitlin. I trust I will see you when Professor Stuvek's classes recommence. Kate nodded, smiling, and gave Strom the Vulcan split-fingered salute, which he returned with grave solemnity before slipping back into his place in his own line. Why is a Vulcan taking Vulcan classes? Wakaba wondered.
Professor Stuvek teaches literature, too. Or at least he did at WPI.
On Friday, word came back from the ships which had gone to the Spirit of the River's last known position. They'd discovered nothing but a lot of wreckage, some unidentifiable, most from a Skrang trader of the Spirit's class. Two bodies were recovered, both Skrang. The Spirit's logboy had not been found. The search continued, but not much hope was held out. Friday night in the castle's beautiful dining hall degenerated into a kind of impromptu wake for Liza Broadbank, and not even Utena's masterful execution of Corwin's grandfather's lasagna recipe could save the occasion from becoming miserable and maudlin. To Liza, said Azalin, raising her glass at one point. The only enemy I never tried to befriend, and the one I most should have. Tachai Malathani, Elizabeth. You were beautiful. Then she drained her glass, threw it into the fire, and went to her room to cry some more. The weekend passed, rainy and dreary, and the duelists and their friends remained disconsolate. It was a sit-around-watching-rain-run-down-the-windows kind of weekend, where the sudden, unseasonal, damp cold seemed to seep through the stone walls of the castle and fight a winning battle with the building's modernized heating systems to give everything a faint, slick edge of chill. Monday morning, though, dawned clear and sunny, the warmth of August coming back to take a curtain call in the first days of September. It was though Gerardo itself didn't want them to inaugurate the first day of classes in this new and beautiful school with such feelings of gloom hanging over them. Caitlin and Utena rose, showered, dressed, and headed downstairs in time to start setting up for a good, hearty group breakfast for the castle dwellers, a gesture of solidarity before plunging headlong into their junior year of high school here on this lovely blue moon. But when they got to the kitchen, they found somebody already at work there.
Aunt Erd? Utena blurted. What the hell are you doing here?
Erd Snowmane, Norn of yesterday and self-proclaimed favorite aunt of Corwin Ravenhair, though she knew full well that Bell was his favorite, Bell was everyone's favorite, and Erd had long since gotten over that, turned round at the range and grinned at Utena. Is that any way to talk to your house guide? She inquired with a cheery wink.
House guide? Said Utena, still confused.
Erd shook her head and tutted with mock disapproval, wagging a finger at Utena. You didn't read your new student handbook, did you? Only to make sure they didn't fix the uniform rule on me, Utena admitted sheepishly.
Well, if you had, Bird informed her, you would know that one of the changes here at DSM is that all residence halls will have, in addition to student resident advisors... We don't have an RA here, Utrina interjected. Dean Montaigne decided that since we're mainly a club residence, the officers could... Don't interrupt me, Bird cut in, then recomposed herself and went on as though she hadn't been interrupted. All residence halls will have, in addition to student resident advisors or their equivalent, with a pointed smirk, an adult house guide, to whom students will be expected to take any problems too serious for a peer to handle, including but not limited to inter-roommate violence, sexual harassment, serious injury, suicide threats or other major crimes, and concerns over drinking, drug use, cybernetic interface addiction, or unplanned pregnancy. You memorized that part of the handbook, said Utrina, giving Erd a half-lidded, skeptical look. Of course I did, Erd replied, drawing herself up importantly. I'm your house guide. They made you a house guide? Erd did her best to look offended, though she knew Utrina was teasing her. They'd become fairly good friends over the course of the summer, with a special understanding cemented during Utrina's brief, unplanned vacation in Asgard a few weeks before. That they did, and I intend to do a bang-up job at it, too, so you'd just better watch yourself, missy, Erd declared. Now have a seat. The pancakes will be... burned, Kate observed, thoughtfully sniffing at the air. What? Erd whirled. Oh, damn it! Bell makes this look so easy. Utrina chuckled, dropping her attitude of mock antagonism. Here, let me, she said, and nudged the goddess out of the way. Why don't you have a seat, she went on, starting to clean up the mess Erd had made, and I'll make the pancakes. Day one went well for the duelists and their company. The first day of classes was never particularly challenging, and the reconstituted faculty of WPI, with a few local additions, seemed to be enjoying the new setting every bit as much as the 60% of the student body who were also transplants. The new students, those who hadn't been to WPI, didn't have as much of an adjustment to make, and so perhaps they didn't have quite the same level of appreciation for DSM's luxuries, but they liked it all the same. At lunchtime, they gathered at Table 11 in the new dining hall and had the first meeting of the Institute Band Geeks Federation. The state of the student orchestra was discussed, as was the somewhat unstable condition of Kate's own band, The Art of Noise. Azalin was feeling somewhat better today. She was still rather subdued, but she didn't look like she might burst out crying at any moment. She was game to start Art of Noise rehearsals as soon as possible, so that the band's two new members, drummer R. Dorothy Wainwright and rhythm guitarist Miki Kaworu, could start getting up to speed. There was hope, though not really ambitious hope, that they might be able to have their first performance during the fall break between terms A and B. That afternoon, when classes were done but before dinner time, Kate met Utrina at the main entrance to the castle, smiling her "I have a surprise for you" smile, and led her puzzled roommate back in the other direction. Remember before you left with Corwin? Kate added. You said we had enough motorheads in the IDS. It was too bad there aren't any roads on Gerardo. Utrina nodded. Nobody seemed to think I was serious. Kate's grin got a little wider as they reached her antique Impala convertible, parked in the corner of the student lot at the bottom of Castle Hill. We were kind of preoccupied, said Kate. She put her hand on the top of the Impala's driver's door and vaulted into the driver's seat without opening it, which made Utrina smile a bit. There had been a time, not all that long ago, when Kate wouldn't have done a thing like that.
She was chuckling to herself about it as she opened her own door and climbed in. Kate gave her a querying look as she fired up the engine. "Nothing," Utrina said, still smiling, to the unspoken question. "You were saying?"
"I was saying," Kate said patiently, that we did take you seriously.
She guided the big car onto the twisty road that wound through the campus, saying as she did so,
"So we talked to Major Clanton, and he talked to Prilar Otano, and he talked to Vedek Barail."
The Impala curved up the sweeping turn around Cummins Observatory and started picking up speed, heading for the hedge fence which marked the edge of campus. On the plans of the campus Utrina had seen before leaving for her tour of space training, the internal road had ended here in a small parking lot slash turnaround. As they drew near, though, she saw that it didn't. In fact, it left the campus, heading off into the wooded hills to the south. Kate threw a shift and accelerated as they passed the fence, her face almost glowing with anticipation and enjoyment. And soon they were roaring through the hills on a shiny new strip of two-lane blacktop. As they charged along, taking the turns with tidy precision and swooping up and down the slopes, Utrina began to realize that she'd seen something like this road before. It was almost more like a race course. It had progressive corners and low striped curbs flanking the bends, and the occasional sand trap off to the sides of the sharper turns. And, she saw as they flew deeper into the woods, it had an on-ramp. An on-ramp which led to a 6-lane, elevated, divided superhighway. She turned to Caitlin and had to shout to be heard over the Impala's slipstream as the brown-haired duelist leader ran the big black car up to 120, grinning fiercely.
"You conned the Corps of Engineers into building a highway complex? On Gerardo?" she cried.
Kate smirked, reached down to the dash, and punched a key above the radio. Instantly, the roar of the wind was muted by the car's climate management field, reducing it to a conversational level without removing that open road feeling.
"We call it the Autobahn," said Kate with a grin. "It was actually Wakaba's idea."
Utrina grinned wryly. "That figures," she said.
"It does technically have a purpose, or the Major wouldn't have been able to swing it," Kate went on. "The freeway part connects the main campus with the recreation complexes at Betrell Beach and the Caucasus Mountains, and the surface roads are backup routes."
Utrina's grin widened.
"Ah, so that's why Wakaba was so enthusiastic about it. She loves beaches. Any excuse to go to the seaside, she'll take it."
Kyuichi-kun was pleased, too," Kate informed her. "He's apparently a fan of camping."
Utrina nodded. "He used to go camping in the Forest of Secrets sometimes. It was against the rules to leave campus during the term without special permission, but being on the student council, he could go into the forest any time he liked." She chuckled. "Weirdo." Kate shrugged.
"It'll help when the time comes for his wilderness survival training."
"That it will. Are you going to take him out into the woods, drop him off, and tell him that if he's not back in a week, you might consider looking for him?"
"Work for Dad and me," replied Kate unconcernedly.
"By the way, it's super surreal to hear you call him Kyuichi-kun," Utrina observed, "and not just because nobody uses Japanese tags in standard except Tomodachiko schoolgirls and Zaibatsu executives." Kate shrugged.
"Katsujin Kenryu is a
Japanese form, she said. He calls me sensei.
You wanted to talk about a surreal feeling, she added wryly.
Anyway, it's only fair.
Bet he gave you a funny look the first time you said it to his face, said Utena. Kate grinned.
Wakaba thinks it's cute.
He doesn't take it as well from her, though, she added with a wink. Utena leaned her chin on her fist, elbow on Ray's knee, and regarded her roommate with a smile.
You're really enjoying yourself, aren't you? She asked. Not just right now, I mean, in general. You've really been up since I got back. Well, except for the times like last night, anyway.
Kate nodded, a shadow flickering across her face.
She said. I think we've been overreacting a little, she went on thoughtfully. I mean the information we have so far is pretty sketchy. Dad and the Skrang are still investigating, and people survive pirate attacks all the time. Even if she was captured, not all pirates are slavers.
Utena nodded. Yeah, I was thinking about that too last night after we went to bed. The way I figure it, the attackers were probably specifically after an Ishkarat ship, so even if they were after the crew, they aren't going to be interested in a human. She grinned. They'll probably either ransom her or dump her on the Outer Rim someplace. She'll hitch a ride back with a free spacer trader or something and be here in time for B-term, and I bet she'll be pissed off, too, she added with a grin.
Kate chuckled at the image. I hope so, she said more soberly. If they do ransom her, her father probably won't pay, she mused.
Then we will, Utrin replied. Or we'll find out where they've got her and go get her.
Kate gave her a smiling, askance look. Duelists to the rescue?
Of course, Utrin replied. She drew herself up importantly and said, I am a prince, you know. It's my duty to rescue young ladies in distress, even bitchy ones, she added, dropping the pretentious pose and grinning. Anyway, she went on as Caitlin giggled, I was just noticing that you're brighter since I was away. Just little things. You shine more. It's hard to explain.
Kate nodded. I know what you mean. I didn't realize it showed on me. But I have a lot to be happy about, she said. I have so many good friends. I have a beautiful school to call home and a beautiful home to go back to when it closes. A family that backs me 100%. A student of my own.
Her cheeks pinkened and she added softly, and someone to love?
Utrin's smile became softer, nostalgic. She leaned back in her seat, hands folded behind her head, stretched, looked up at the flickering play of light and shadow that the afternoon sun made through the trees flanking this stretch of highway, and said, Nice feeling, isn't it?
Kate's own smile faltered a little. She reached across the bench seat and held out her hand, and said in an apologetic tone,
You'll get her back. I know you will.
Utena glanced at her, then took her hand, squeezed it, and said, Yeah, I know. Don't worry. Don't apologize for your good fortune just because I've had some bad luck. She chuckled.
It won't hurt my feelings if you don't share my loneliness, she said lightly, trying her best to make a joke out of it.
Anyway,
she went on, the lightness in her voice less forced now. I have some good friends to see me through, too, you know. Mia Ausa finished her first day's reading for Professor Ford's Intermediate Comparative Religion class, closed her textbook, and pushed her chair back from the desk with a yawning, stretching sigh. I don't see how you can stand that stuff, said Belana Torres from the sofa she'd scrounged for the room, the bed being useless for the traditional dorm room accommodation of seated guests. It's so dull. None of it has any practical value. Lying on her stomach with her chin propped on her hands, she flipped a leaf in her electrodynamics text and continued offhandedly, Besides, I'd have figured you'd have had enough of that kind of thing on Minbar. Mia turned her chair and smiled patiently. She didn't particularly mind having acquired a sidekick, but sometimes Belana got the oddest ideas about things. Not every Minbari prays for a living, she said. Admittedly, my mother belonged to the religious caste, but there was a good deal more to my life on Minbar than religion. Said Belana skeptically. To hear Chenan tell it, there's sewers, too. Mia laughed. Well, sewers are important, she said. More important than religion, by some standards. Anyway, if it's so nice there, Belana asked, why'd you leave? Mia's smile slipped a little. She looked pensive as she replied, Well, that's a good question. I guess when you get right down to it, my situation wasn't so different from yours. That's one of the reasons I took your uncle's attitude toward your future so personally. Belana grinned. And that's why you whomped him so hard? Mia's smile returned, with a hint of mischief, and she replied, Well, mostly that was because he cheated. And tried to kill me, she didn't add. But I challenged him because of that, yes. He reminded me of the reasons why I left Minbar. Oh yeah? The half-Klingon girl shut her book, sat up, and looked eager. Like what? Mia gazed at her just long enough to make her uncomfortable, then said, All right, I'll tell you about it.